I am ready to record.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I should have cleared my throat first, though, because that wasn't very good.
Oh, no, that was fine.
Why, when you call me, don't you throw these into, like, the beginning of it? I don't know why that's not your intro.
Would you like me to do that?
No.
I think that's a great
idea.
It
would only be cool if I didn't have to tell you to do it.
No, but I think it's a great idea, and I like that we collaborate and do that.
Collaborate and listen. Like that?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I should probably just write you a song.
Well, yeah, you probably should write me a song. And how would it begin?
Hello? I don't know, actually. I just definitely stole Lionel Richie.
Okay, I got
but
it.
That's how I have to answer the phone, because you just call me. Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Hey everybody, thanks for downloading episode 146 of the Golf Unfiltered podcast. I'm your host as always, Adam from golfunfiltered.com. Follow me on Twitter, @golfunfiltered. Send me an email, golfunfiltered@gmail.com. Today's guest is Mr. John Kim, now of US Kids Golf. John and I have connected on Twitter in the past, and he is going to share a story of all the different things that he has done throughout his career in golf. And I think you'll agree that there are very few people on this earth that have done as much as he has and who has seen and met the people that John Kim has as well. Just a quick little backstory, and John, if you're listening to this, I hope you don't mind me sharing it. But, you know, I've talked about on Twitter a couple times some of the mistakes that I make helping make this podcast happen. John and I actually had an interview about 2 or 3 days ago prior to recording this interview that you're about to hear. The entire recording got lost. It was a complete user error thing. It was just, oh God, it was so frustrating, and I was embarrassed and mortified. And of course, as I knew he would, John was so gracious and he was so welcoming to this opportunity to do a mulligan with him. And that's what we did today. And so, you know, the good thing about this situation, trying to find the silver lining and positive spin on this, is that I learned a lot about John, and I had the opportunity to talk to him twice now about his career. Definitely as, or if not more, impressed with what he's done the second time I've talked to him, but really do appreciate, and just goes to show the type of person that he is, and how a lot of people are in this game. And so I hope you enjoy this conversation with John. Before we get to the episode, though, I would just want to throw out a quick reminder to go out to our Patreon page, patreon.com/golfunfiltered, if you want to offer some support to the show, and I'll try to do a better job by not making those mistakes anymore. But anyway, I hope you guys enjoy this conversation. Sit back, relax. Here's John Kim. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. As I mentioned in the introduction, I am happy to welcome for the first time on the show, Mr. John Kim from US Kids Golf. John, how are you today?
Hey, Adam. Thank you so much for having me. You know, long-time listener, first-time caller. So it's a great thing to be here.
It's one of the favorite things I hear on sports radio. I know that you and I have talked before, and you said that maybe you're not listening to as much sports radio anymore?
I do listen some. I wouldn't say that I'm a devout listener, but I listen enough just to make me angry, and then I find something else.
Nice. So you're in the Atlanta area, and I'm in the Chicago area, but we've got we're recording this on a Saturday. It's the NFL playoffs. It's a big day for both of us.
It's a very big deal for me. The whole Chicago New England thing, you're gonna have to explain to me one day. But even more so than that, as a Patriots fan, I don't know how you get excited about a divisional round playoff game. But as a Falcons fan, last year's success notwithstanding, every playoff game is a big deal. Every opportunity to do something like that for us is a very big deal. And it's been so football crazy around here this week. Depending on when your listeners are listening to this, but we just had a college football national championship here.
Yep.
This week as well. So the city's basically been just painted in red and black, and in a sense, just kind of killing time between football games. So it's been neat.
Yeah, man, it's. I'll tell you that story one day about. It's completely a bandwagon story. I'll just be completely honest to everyone. List. I definitely jumped on the bandwagon a while ago. But before we get too ahead of ourselves here, John, for folks who might not know the name of John Kim, why don't you let us know a little bit about how you got involved in the game? And you've been involved with some pretty impressive organizations through your career.
Well, thank you. For those that haven't heard of John Kim, congratulations, because that means you've got a pretty normal life. But I have been probably, as far as people I know, a very, very, very small amount of people get as lucky as I have. And I'm not trying to be give you guys any false humility there. That was just been for a guy who did not grow up in the game, who didn't have any background in golf, who doesn't have any particular talents, in golf, I've gotten to do some really cool things. So the long story short is that I had an opportunity to get involved in golf in a real peripheral level. When I was working my first job out of college, I worked at CNN Headline News. Mm-hmm. And we had to work overnights. When you first get that job, you get the graveyard shift. And so I had to find something to do during the day. And I had interned at CNN Sports, and so me and some of the guys that I'd met, we decided we were going to become golfers. And so we go to this little par 3 executive course here in the Atlanta area, and as it happens with so many other people, the bug hits, and I decide, boy, I really love playing. At the same time, and this tells you I'm a little bit older than a lot of your listeners, but this was when the internet was first kind of getting mainstream traction.
Wow.
And I found a website while looking for places to go play golf called AtlantaGolfer.com. Hmm. And I realized that the site didn't have as much information as I wanted. So I contacted the site and asked them, hey, you've got basic information. You've got phone numbers, directions, those things, but you don't have any course reviews. You don't have any tips from the pros. You don't have any images. And they said, well, we're not really golfers. We just thought this was a real opportunity, and we're programmers. So I volunteered my services to be their editorial director. Hmm. And they were concerned because they said, well, we don't have any kind of budget to pay you. And I was like, ah, don't worry about it. Just as long as I'm official, this is all I need. And so this was great because, as I said, the golf bug had hit. But I didn't think I'd ever escape the little par 3 executive course, layout. I thought that was my life in golf, which I'd have been pretty happy with, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
But all of a sudden, I'm now executive director for AtlantaGolfer.com, and I start contacting courses everywhere in Atlanta. And they start welcoming me out. Come on out. Play our course. Treat you to a round of golf, you and a friend. Treat you to lunch, whatever. They knew that the value of a good review, even back then, how powerful it could be. So that developed as part of that. Atlanta was hosting a couple of golf events. The Bell South Classic was here in Atlanta as a tour event at the time. There was an LPGA event. There were all kinds of golf going on. And so I developed a little bit of a niche here in the Atlanta market. What just so happened, as this was progressing and progressing well, the company, Turner Broadcasting, which is the parent company of CNN,
right,
also started a online sports division, Turner Sports Interactive.
And I remember Turner Sports.
So they created an interactive licensing deal with a lot of major sports leagues, and that included NASCAR, which was their first, the NBA. And their third was the PGA of America. And that was someone that I had interned with was now kind of an executive there and said, wow, nobody knows more about golf than you, John. Why don't you come over and work with us on PGA.com? Hmm. And so, that didn't take me very long to decide that was going to be a fun move. And so I went to PGA.com. That was in 2006. And immediately I am, off to cover the Ryder Cup and the PGA Championship and the Club Pro Championship, which, by the way, is my favorite event in golf.
Yeah.
And am working with guys that are the head pros at Whistling Straits and Kiawah and Pebble Beach, and all of them, as golf pros do, because they're the best people in the world, but they'd like, John, come out and see us sometime. Hmm. And so I'm just in heaven. And for 10 years, I had the best job in golf. I was riding around in Scotland with Tom Watson. I'm walking the fairways of Pebble Beach with their head pro at the time, Chuck Dunbar. I'm playing at Bandon Dunes. I mean, I'm just having the greatest time. So, and then I had an opportunity, not to bore you with too many details, but after 10 years and I'm having a great time and I feel like we're doing some good things, one of the people and organizations that I met during my time was the Folds of Honor, based out of Tulsa, Oklahoma, mm-hmm. Technically Owosso. And as I got to know their leadership, they had asked me to consider possibly, oh, let me back up for a moment. So sure. I got a little bit lucky. I had unbelievable support staff around me at PGA.com. And based on some early decisions that were made, and a lot of fun risks, if you want to call it that, and the PGA was phenomenal about it. We were one of the first sports organizations to really try to make a dent in the idea of social media when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And because we were one of the first, we were also very fortunate to be recognized as one of the first. And so I actually collected a few industry awards for my work kind of in that digital space and
really?
The social space.
That I was not aware of.
No, that was like I said, I probably got some trophies that probably deserved other people's names on it. But that was fine because I wasn't giving it back. It was like,
I would say, don't you hold on to that thing.
We can share it. We'll just keep it at my house, right?
That's fine.
So it opened up some opportunities for me. Some other organizations would inquire as to if I had any interest in potentially doing something different. Well, the one that really struck me was this opportunity at the Folds of Honor because, mm-hmm. As you know, and as a lot of people know, you reach certain points in your life where you really want to feel like you're doing something that's for the betterment of the whole. And like I said, I could have been happy at PGA.com and Turner Sports for a very long time. It is such a great place. But I felt like if I were ever going to do something different in my life with whatever skills and resources and connections that I had accumulated and aggregated over the years, this would be a great mission to work with. And for over a year, it really, really was. But to their credit, Folds of Honor really grew quickly. And at some point, we realized that the logistics of me living in Atlanta and working out of Atlanta just wasn't very either cost efficient or strategic to what Folds of Honor needed.
Right.
So we took a little bit of time. It was just like, okay, let's find somebody that could do that a little bit in better proximity. But I wasn't going to move to Owosso, Oklahoma. And then I got, again, just kind of grace of God type move. I get a phone call really right as I thought, okay, what do I want to do next? From an organization that is right down the street from my house called U.S. Kids Golf.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I knew of U.S. Kids Golf, but I didn't really know what U.S. Kids Golf was all about. I thought of them as an equipment company for kids, and that's absolutely true. But it's not just an equipment company. It's by far the largest share of kids' youth equipment. But even more, they host 1,300 tournaments a year.
Wow.
From local tours all the way up to the World Championship, which we can talk more about here in a bit. And they certify coaches. They are a behemoth, huge, kind of almost dominant organization when it comes to everything youth golf. Well, I wondered when I first got there, Adam, if youth golf would satisfy my ambitions about golf.
Sure.
Because I was used to being inside at the Ryder Cup and these media centers that held 500 people and all of those things. But I wanted things on scale. I wanted to impress with just magnitude and grandeur. And I don't know that I've ever been happier.
Really?
And that's saying something because I've always been very blessed and happy in my career. But in this particular position, I actually see on a real tangible day-to-day basis the difference that this organization makes in not just in golf, but as our mission statement reads, in families. I got a text this morning from a gentleman from England that I have never met.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent me a direct message via, I can't remember if it was Twitter or Facebook, and he just said that he and his son were in the Tampa area playing in the Copperhead Classic, which is one of our regional events.
Mm-hmm.
And that he just wanted me to be aware that he had, they had tweeted out a photo of them there at Innisbrook and that they were having a great time. And that's it. These are the kind of notes that I get all the time.
Nice.
About how much fun or how important it is that these bonding moments that families have together as they travel and play golf. We encourage parents to caddy for their players in the tournaments. So all of that said, these are real, real moments for families to create memories together. So I think you asked me for a short background on my career in life, and I think I just went on about probably – I would have been gonged out a long time ago.
No.
That's just a long way of saying that I've been really lucky. I've been involved in golf on just about every level, and, you know, everyone from Arnold Palmer – Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, all the way down to the 6-year-old girl who got the ball in the air for the first time, and I've been, you know, a close part of all of those success stories, and that's just been the greatest career route I can even imagine, much less being able to experience it firsthand.
The fact that you've been such a journeyman across many different levels of the game is the reason we wanted you on. And John, it's interesting to hear all these stories, but you touched on something in your most, when you were talking about joining US Kids Golf, you know, you came from the grand scale of the PGA Tour and some of the biggest names that fans of this sport will always know. And then you go towards just a different world, as you explained. How long did it take you to realize how rewarding that jump was from the professional ranks down to, as you mentioned, kids learning the game for the first time?
You know, I think it kind of goes, it's not a gradual realization. It's almost that hockey stick type graph.
Sure.
You know, you're slowly building. You're thinking, okay, I get it. I sort of see it. This is nice. I had a chance in 2016 for the first time to go to the U.S. Kids Golf World Championship. It's held every year at Pinehurst. And you can imagine the logistical challenge to host over 1,500 players over 12 golf courses.
Wow.
And families representing 54 countries. We're talking language issues. We're talking just a hotel and food and all of those things that are going to be a challenge for everybody. But I'm there and I see this parade that they have and these kids line up. It's a combination of what I would call the Olympic Parade of Nations, you know, where the countries walk in under their banner and they're all
sure.
cheering. And so that's the beauty of it. Now, the passion of it, the closest thing I can think of is almost like the Ryder Cup. Because these kids have so much pride in who they're representing, not just themselves and their families, but their nations. And so, you know, you walk over to the contingent from Colombia, or you walk over to the contingent from Australia, and they have traveled all the way around the world. And they are, you know, they're dressed in team colors. They've got, even though they're not a team, they're each playing individually. But for the purpose of this parade, they typically have you know, the same color or the same type of T-shirt on or golf shirt. They bring gifts, you know, people I've never met. And I'm walking out of there with all these nice little trinkets, koala bears from Australia and keychains. And I've got a little collection here on my desk at home. I can't really describe it better in a way than you really, really enjoy it. You take it in as both an experience and as a connection. And I don't know, I've never really had a particular affinity for, I shouldn't say a particular affinity, but I've never had a particular calling for youth golf. Mm. I was so caught up in golf at on the other end of the spectrum, when it comes to, who's going to qualify for the majors, who's going to win the Ryder Cup. But there's a certain, both innocence and excitement about golf that's happening there. It's still World Championship. They did a documentary on this U.S. Kids Golf World Championship a few years ago called The Short Game.
Right.
And that's available on Netflix. I think it's a Justin Timberlake production.
That's right.
It was, you know, we've had Golf Digest there. We've had the Golf Channel there. We've had Sports Illustrated and ESPN has come and covered this. So it's big. But at the same time, you know, down on it, when you get to the micro level, it's a dad just proud of his kid. You know, a mom seeing hours of driving her son or daughter to practice and local and regional events now culminating in this World Championship. Now, some of the kids there are going to be world champions. Mm-hmm. You know, probably our most famous world champion alumni, Lexi Thompson, has won it.
Right.
You know, winning is so good, but really more important is accomplishing, doing your best. If you can shoot a good score, I've seen kids, you know, who didn't crack the top 50, and they are out celebrating because he had his best score of his life here at the World Championship, you know, just rising to the occasion. And maybe that's a 78, and the winners are shooting 68. Doesn't matter.
Right.
So, you know, I would encourage everybody who loves golf to come see one of these youth golf events. Now, Adam, I know you and I have talked before in the past about the health and the state of golf.
Yes.
And I look at what happens at this level, and it gives me great confidence that golf is in good shape.
I mean, I would say it was, because you mentioned 1,500 kids across 54 countries. To me, that doesn't sound like a game that's hurting.
So I get frustrated, and, you know, I think golf will continually evolve. I think golf will grow at varying speeds, and there'll be some hills and valleys. But the doomsday forecast, the doom and gloom, sports and, you know, analysts, I don't know what they are looking at or what they're comparing things to. I know in terms of business, many of the companies that I know are doing better than they ever have. Now, you know, is it true that we still have some challenges where golf courses overbuilt back in the 90s and 2000s? Yeah, probably. But that doesn't mean that the game is going anywhere. Again, things will evolve. Things will change. And there will continually be new efforts to make the game a little bit more accessible, a little bit more affordable, a little bit more or a little bit less time-consuming for certain people.
Mm-hmm.
But if you love golf like I do, and I don't just love working in golf. I love working in golf in part because I love playing golf, and I love all the benefits that I get from going out and playing. And I know you've laughed before when I said, you know, I'm averaging about 130, 140 rounds a year.
That's just insane. That's so good.
Yeah. And I get angry when it's not more, because I really enjoy it. And I'm not the only one. There's so many people like me out there that golf is going to be in good hands. It is. I don't think that it needs to be pigeonholed as elitist and only a certain segment of the population, will be out there enjoying it. I think that it's going to continue to be a very open sport where anybody that really has an interest has an opportunity to at least go and try it. Now, golf, as an industry, you know, has certain inherent costs on it.
Sure.
So maybe not everybody is the right audience. And that's okay. There can be an aspirational aspect to it. But I've heard you say before, golf doesn't necessarily have to mean the green grass facility and the 18-hole walk with caddy or whatever it is that people traditionally think of it.
Right. The definition's changing over time.
Yeah, I think so. My wife does. I pay more money than I even like to belong to a club, and my wife probably couldn't find it without using Waze. But she loves Topgolf.
Yeah.
And she loves, and so she enjoys the athleticism of it, of swinging a club. She just doesn't feel like she has the time to go out or the discipline, quite honestly, to strategize her way around a course for a certain amount of hours. That's okay.
Yeah.
I would love for her to play. I would love for us to enter our twilight years, you know, plotting our way around a good West Coast swing. whether that ever happens or not, I'll know that, you know, I can still take her to a type golf or even a driving range, and I think she'd have a good time.
Well, John, your twilight years are years ahead, so you got plenty of time to worry about that.
I hope that's the case.
You know, what's funny is when you talk about just the way that the definition of golf is changing and the way that it's being played is changing at Topgolf, driving ranges and the like. And I'm sure there's other concepts that are coming out. But one of the things that I know you and I have talked about is just understanding how people play the game differently, just from a ability standpoint as it relates to how far they hit the ball. You know, what are some things that you've seen that are changing in the game regarding just, hey, let's get this show moving a little bit quicker when we get out there to play, so it doesn't take all day.
This, Adam, thank you for bringing that up. This is one of the things that I have struggled with over the years, and I think recently I found something that really kind of resonates with industry folks who understand the game, and myself, certainly. It kind of hit me pretty hard. As you said, golf is an ego-driven game, and I'm very guilty of that too. You know, you show up to the course, and you don't want to necessarily be the one that suggests, hey, let's move up a set of tees. Even though I think by almost all measures, most golfers would enjoy it. But, you know, there's a limited number of tee options. Let's just say there's a tips, a blue, a white, and a red at any golf courses. And guys just have that ego. I've got to at least play the blues because that's just what they do.
Right.
So the U.S. Kids Golf Foundation came up with a concept studying some data that said that every club in your bag is a fixed percentage of how far you carry your driver, how far your driver carries the ball. Let's just, for example, say 240.
Sure.
And I think the 7-iron, don't quote me on that, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the 7-iron, just for example, would be around 63% of that.
Okay.
And so it doesn't matter. That holds true no matter whether you carry it 240 or 140. Now, the idea was, would it be more fun if every golfer had the same experience on a hole as opposed to trying to scale the course using the tees that exist now so that golfers would hit the ball into the same landing area?
Hmm.
Because everyone knows if you've got 170 yards in, for some people that might be a 6 or 7 iron, and for other people it's a 3-wood. And the person that's hitting the 6 or 7 iron is going to beat the person that's hitting the 3-wood to get that, make that happen 99 times out of 100.
Right.
So the U.S. Kids Golf Foundation purchased a golf facility in Southern Pines, North Carolina, called Longleaf Golf Club. it's been renamed Longleaf Golf and Family Club. And they installed 7 sets of tees. And each of those tees are different colors, but they don't correspond to the traditional red, white, blue, black. And they ask you to figure out how far you hit the ball in the air, and they have a driving range there that'll help you determine that. And then they will say, okay, you are a purple tee player. And what I've seen, or what we've seen, is that golfers who try this method out, and that's everyone from tour caliber players, folks who compete on various tours, all the way down to, you know, Mrs. Haverkamp,
right,
Caddyshack, hitting the ball about 100 yards, and they are having a blast.
Huh.
I've seen golf groups come in there and look at this and say, okay, so there's no ego involved here. It is strict data. It is the metrics say you hit it this far, you play from this tee. Now, you don't have to adhere to this, but it is allowing the guy that hits it a long way to hit driver 8-iron into a green, and his friend will also hit driver 8-iron into the green. They may be playing 2 sets up.
Right.
And it has become an industry kind of the momentum has been big. We, the American Society of Golf Course Architects, and in particular, Reese Jones, saw this, came out, took a look, and said, we want to be a part of this.
Really? Reese Jones wants to be a part of this concept?
Absolutely. He's already installed it at Medina number 3.
Now, listeners, I actually knew that, but I wanted to prop John into bringing that up, because I had heard at John, when you and I last spoke about this concept, I remembered, holy cow, I know this is going on at Medina, where I live in the area, of course, and it was like, that obviously was what John was talking about. So that just blows my mind that I didn't make that connection sooner.
So, yeah. So, you know, it's fun to feel like you make a difference. It's fun to feel like that the organization that you're a part of is doing something really for the betterment of golf, and not obviously not just for the company's bottom line. And the people that have been involved in this, and the people that have benefited from this, I mean, the number of rounds at Longleaf have skyrocketed because people are playing more. Why? Because they're enjoying it more. They're playing faster. I mean, you think about all the shots forgive me for sounding so stereotypical here, but there are Williams groups that play from that just aren't fair to them. Mm-hmm. But those are the only options they have. And so certain par fours, they really just realistically cannot reach in regulation. So they've got what one friend of mine who's an architect, Bill Bergen, calls inconsequential shots, where they have to hit a drive, and then they have to hit a 3-wood before they actually have a shot onto the green that matters for their scoring on a par 4.
Right.
And so rounds that used to take 4 hours and 45 minutes are all of a sudden taking 4 hours, or in 9-hole leagues used to be 2:20, are now taking about, you know, an hour 50 to 2 hours, and they are having a blast. So they come out and they play more. They have more fun. They have more people playing. It's just this great cycle of growing the game, of building up the health of the game.
You know, it's interesting, not to interrupt, but it's interesting because my wife plays the game, and she played college softball full ride 4 years. She can hit the ball. But to your point that you just brought up, you know, stereotypically or I don't know, that's not the right word, but traditionally, you know, women are asked to play the forward tees. And I remember a round vividly where we played at a local course here where she did just that. And to your point, every single time she hit driver, she found herself, she was driving directly into a hazard or a bunker, or it wasn't fair. It wasn't set up for her to have the best experience that she could. And I remember her looking at me at one point. She goes, "What's the point? No matter what I do, I either have to hit driver and play out of the sand every single hole, or I hit 7-iron where I have to hit 3-wood for my second shot."
Exactly. Yeah. You know, if she were playing at a Longleaf T-System course, there, Adam, because that is gender neutral. It doesn't matter if you're male or female. It just matters how far your ball goes, and that's the team you play from. So you easily could see any number of men and or ladies playing from the same set of tees, and there's no I'm sorry, the word's not coming to me, so I'll just come with, there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
Because that's just simply how far you hit the ball. And, you know, I laugh all the time because we do need to, as an industry, we need to kind of break this idea that the and I'm a traditionalist in many, many, many ways. But the idea that certain norms and the culture of golf needs to change in some ways, I very much agree with as well. I'll give you a quick example.
Sure.
At my club. And my club is a ridiculously good playing club. I got a buddy of mine, his index is one, less than one. And he was in flight three of the club championship. So we just have a lot of pride in how good these players are.
Wow.
You know, it's also one of those that pace of play is extremely important. And there was some hackles raised. I had a, on one particular Saturday morning a couple years ago, when one of the female members of the club, I invited to play with us in my group on Saturday morning. And we show up and a couple of the older guys was like, this is going to be, can't hold up the course. This is a problem. Oh, she also happens to be a former collegiate All-American golfer, finalist at USGA. You know, and she shoots 68 there, rolled out of bed to shoot 68. And, you know, but they had no idea, right? Because they just, they're so blinded by what they traditionally think of when they see, young lady bring her golf clubs up on the range on a Saturday morning. There are a lot of ways that golf can be fun for everyone. I think that we need to, as long as pace of play, which is huge, can be kept up, as long as the golf course does a good job of not only maintaining that, but providing a proper golf course, good conditions for people to play. I feel good about golf. I feel good, but if I were a betting man, I would bet high on the future of golf. I'd invest in that.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I mean, the story that you outlined for us and the concept that you described sounds extremely exciting. And John, I want to transition a little bit, to a few questions here that I've got jotted down. And,
sure.
A little bit of rapid fire. This is something a little bit new that I'm trying. You may know or you may remember, I actually had a buddy of yours, Josh Babbitt, on earlier on a previous episode. He says hello, by the way. And he had a few answers to these questions, but first and foremost, as a guy like yourself who travels all over the place or who has traveled all over the place, you see a lot of airports. In your opinion, what is the best airport to get in and out of, and which is the worst?
The best airport to get in and out of is a little airport in Bend, Oregon, because it's so small and there's never a wait. The other is I don't know the name of the airport, but it was the only time in my life I got to fly private. So wherever that airport is in St. Louis, God bless them, because that was one of the great experiences of my life.
Nice.
Commercially, I do not like, please nobody send me hate tweets. I don't like the New York airports.
Mm-hmm.
LaGuardia, I just never really had a real smooth, great experience there. And I'll go ahead and throw my own airport under the bus in Atlanta. If you don't know what you're doing in Atlanta, I helped more lost people than I care to count.
Yeah.
All right, let's go ahead and throw one more. Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
All my golf buddies know this. Leaving Orlando, that security line, every year after the show, well, that's like waiting for a Disneyland, Disney World ride there.
So, yeah, it's pretty bad.
Yeah. So those are probably my least. And as far as my if there's one commercial airport that I think, okay, this is going to be pretty easy, smooth in and out. All right, let's go with West Palm Beach.
Oh, nice.
It's pretty, and it's big enough to get you where you need to go, but it's not so big that it's easy to get in and out of, get your rental car, get out, take you back.
Perfect. Now, obviously, you eat a lot of places, too, and you go to a lot of cities, as you've just described. Where's the best city that you could think of to grab a quick meal?
San Francisco has a great variety, and it's better if you're on a company expense account. I always enjoy meeting friends for dinner in that area. The steakhouses in both, I'm thinking Kansas City, Tulsa, which I went to several times, obviously, with at Folds of Honor, has some good steakhouses. I'll go ahead and say that Orlando, during the show, always has some really good options. So let's go with those three.
That makes a lot of sense. And you had mentioned the PGA show, which is coming up here in a couple weeks from the time that we're recording this. Do you feel that the PGA show still worth it in your mind?
Yes. And I'll caveat that with, to me, the greatest thing about golf, and we've talked today, and again, thank you for having me on. We've talked about so many things that we love about golf, the places that you can go, the experiences you have, the golf courses, and how beautiful they are. The best thing about golf is the people. And there's not one other time of the year when you have so many great people from the golf world aggregated, collected in one place. I have met some of my greatest friends in life. They're at that show. You mentioned Josh Babbitt with the Hacker's Paradise. Josh and I met by chance at a Nike golf event a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But I immediately knew, hey, here's somebody that's just a good person. It's a lot of fun. Some of my other good friends, I know that you're friends with Chad Coleman, #Chad from Callaway Golf.
Yeah, we chat every so often.
Okay, well, Chad has been my guest, my member guest here at my club. A couple of times.
Nice.
Another friend over again with Callaway Golf is Harry Arnett.
Mm-hmm.
Harry has a good close Atlanta tie. I met him at the show, and we talk, especially during football season, almost every day through some text about the Falcons. People I've met who are just starting companies. Some of them I know are going to go huge. Some of them I say I'm never going to see them here again. But at that show, you get a real pulse for the passion and the excitement that golf evokes out of folks from both a personal and a professional sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. I love that energy. I love that hope that I see. The show happens, and it really only can happen when the big players are there and are excited. So when Titleist and Cobra and TaylorMade and Callaway, where so many of my friends are, when they're there and they have good product and people are excited to see it, that drives the show. But for me, it's the smaller stories that I really, really appreciate and enjoy. And that goes along with the people that I mentioned. So, yes, the show is worth it because the people that you meet, the connections you make from a professional and a personal basis, I think it's absolutely worth it. This will be my 15th show. A lot of the things that used to happen at the show back in the day, going ahead and put on my grandpa voice, those probably have become a little bit more secondary. Product launches happen probably more on Twitter than they do at the show now.
Yeah.
But that's okay. That's okay. And orders are still being written at the show, maybe not as much as they were 10, 20 years ago. There's maybe a different expectation from the companies in terms of, are we going to make our money back here? You might, but it's probably a different type of ROI. You may make it in terms of publicity and relationships as opposed to straight bottom line revenue.
I got one more for you, and we'll get you out of here, John. John Kim is a very common name. You've told me this. You somehow secured at John Kim with a little blue check mark on Twitter. That's incredible. How did that happen?
That is, unfortunately, maybe my single best greatest accomplishment, and that didn't have much to do with it. We had a representative from Twitter come into the office when I was at Turner Sports. And, of course, Turner Sports had spent significant amount of money with Twitter, so they were predispositioned to be nice to us. And our representative, that kind of overall Turner Sports, our social media director, said to the lady from Twitter, said, "I really want you to meet John Kim. He has done some good things in the social sphere with one of our properties and recently won an award, et cetera." And at the time, I'd gone through two or three Twitter names, and they were awful. I was embarrassed at how weak they were. And so we met, and she was very cordial and nice and real, you know, professional, but just also personable. And she said, "Well, as a good professional would do," she said, "well, if there's anything I can ever do for you, let me know." I'm sure she didn't think I would take her up on that. And I said, "Well, Lauren, there is." And she kind of laughed, and she was like, "You're not going to ask for a verification check mark, are you?" And I was like, "Oh, no." I said, "You know, if that were to happen, that'd be great. Like, no, that's not what I'm asking for." I said, "I need a better Twitter name." And she said, "Well, what's wrong with the one you have?" And I told her, and she's like, "Oh, that is bad." And I said, "There is a @JohnKim out there. Somebody, probably the day that Twitter launched, somebody claimed that name. But they never tweeted. They followed like one person. They didn't tweet. It was a dead account." And she said, "Well, we do have some rules regarding whether we can take a name from some other account that already exists. But let me see what I can do." Mm-hmm. And she was there actually for 2 days. So the next day, I walk into the office and she said, "Have you looked at your account yet?" And I said, "No." And she said, "We'll do that because I need to know if something happened before I leave here this afternoon." I said, "Okay." So I log in and I look at my account and I see my account name has changed to @JohnKim. And this got the little blue mark. And I'm like, "Oh, my God, I'm somebody. I am someone." Now, hilariously, there's an actor out there on a show. It's actually, ironically, a Turner show on TNT called The Librarians.
Mm-hmm.
His name is John Kim as well.
Yep.
So I get probably over the course of a week a dozen tweets designed for someone else, not me. and sometimes I just ignore them. Sometimes I'll answer them in a kind of a fun way. But for him, whenever that show is on, and I don't even know, Rebecca Romaine and John Larroquette are also on the show or something. So it's got a pretty good following.
Yep.
Whenever that show is on, my Twitter just notifications light up. And it's off. And he and I have connected and kind of talked online a few times about it. And I've sent him a golf bag with John Kim on it, just even though he doesn't play golf. So, you know, it's a blessing 99% of the time. It's a curse 1% of the time. But if that's my one accomplishment before my time here is up, I think that's pretty good. Just small town kid from Riverdale gets the most coveted Twitter name in the universe, is the way I look at it.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is Mr. John Kim, not the star of Turner's Librarians, but he's done a lot of great things in golf. I hope that came across in today's episode. You can follow him on Twitter @JohnKim, as we just discussed. John, I really appreciate you coming on and doing this with us today.
Yeah, anytime, Adam. Thank you so much for having me, and continue the great work.